Okay, so this is the title. Let me give you a little outline. I must say, I gave a similar talk 2 days ago in Irvine, and it went quite slowly, and therefore the interesting part, the recent work I did, was kind of squeezed. So today here, taking advantage of the fact that this subject has been probably discussed in other seminars, I will do the opposite. I will try to go fast in the first part and leave some time for the new work. So I will start very smoothly and slowly on the string black hole correspondence, just to remind you of something and also establishing some notation. And then I will move to the real subject, which is Transplanctian string collisions. Try to argue that in that problem there are three length scales and correspondingly three regimes. And then I will discuss the three regimes in turn. Small angle, a stringy regime, and finally large angle regime, which is this new work we did. And in particular, both in this and in this regime, we will be trying to approach, although that is where the problem becomes hard, even to overcome some critical value for some parameters, leading possibly to gravitational collapse. Now, the string black hole correspondence, very quickly, I remind you of the well-known facts about string theories, string theory entropy, or counting of states in string theory. Since the late 60s, we know that the entropy of strings at three levels grows linearly in the mass. It's the point here. Goes linearly in the mass, or in the length of the string associated with that mass. Now, this led to the concept of a limiting temperature in string theory, Hagedorn temperature of the order of the string mass scale. And of course, I emphasize that in this three-level string entropy, there is no coupling constant involved, in particular, no Newton constant. Now, as you turn instead to black hole entropy, it is known from the work of Bekenstein and Hawking that the entropy can be given in different equivalent forms. It's either the mass times the Schwarzschild radius, or the area of the horizon in Planck units. And in any case, it grows with m with a power which is bigger than 1. So when you compare the black hole and the string entropy, it's clear that at small m, the string has more entropy than the black hole for the same mass. And at sufficiently large m is the black hole, which has more entropy. So the two entropies must meet somewhere. And obviously, if you look, for instance, at this expression for the black hole entropy, they meet when the Schwarzschild radius equals the string length parameter, which is to say that the black hole or Bekenstein-Hawking temperature is equal to the Hagedorn temperature. Of course, all this discussion is modulo numerical factors of order 1. Well, I like to call string holes states which satisfy this entropy matching condition, which is reached when you try to work out the correspondence point, given the fact that Planck and string length, at least for heterotic string, for instance, is driven by the string coupling squared, you find that the matching is reached at a value of the mass, of the energy, which is parametrically larger than the string scale by 2 inverse powers of the string coupling, which is supposed to be small, or by some strange power of the negative power of the coupling in terms of the Planck mass. The common value of the string and black hole entropy at that matching point is given essentially by the inverse of the string coupling square, or say some alpha gap to the minus one. So it could be considered to be a relatively large number, or in any case we will take it as a free parameter and we'll make it arbitrarily large anyway. So to summarize, if we plot things in a coupling constant energy or mass plane, there is an hyperbola which divides this plane into two regions. One region is where string entropy exceeds black hole entropy, and the other region in which black hole entropy exceeds three-level string entropy. And a safe conclusion, I think, from this picture is that in these regions there shouldn't be any black holes in string theory, because the would-be black hole would have an horizon, a Schwarzschild radius, which is smaller than the size of the object itself. What is much harder to argue, but I think it will be a very interesting issue in view of the results I will present later, is whether strings in this regime in which there are strong gravitational effects could also be thought as black holes, whether there is a correspondence between strings and black holes in this regime. There has been work by Gary and Joe, and by Damour and myself on this issue, but I don't want to go into that now. So, with this little introduction, which I think the main use of it is the fact that there is, sorry, maybe I go back to, no, this is the right picture. So, we have to remember that as we will actually keep the coupling constant fixed, we will be moving along this direction, increasing the energy of the collision, and therefore we expect that there is some kind of threshold for black hole production which is parametrically bigger than the string and the Planck scale, and this is where actually we will be working. So, Trans-Planckian string collision means simply that we will look at Trans-Planckian energy, namely GS much weaker than 1, collisions of light strings, massless strings, for instance. And we want to do this within a consistent quantum theory of gravity, where supposedly the problem is well posed. Now, the motivations are twofold. Obvious theoretical motivations, which are related to the famous information paradox. We would like to see whether, although we don't expect this to happen, the S-matrix description is breaking down in some regime and whether quantum coherence is lost. By now, even Hawking seems to agree that presumably quantum coherence is not lost in a process in which classically you would form a black hole starting from some initial state. But if it is not lost, then what is the final state? Is the final state any close to thermal? Or in other words, where is the hair? Okay, where do you find in the final state all the information about the state which went in the first place? Then, okay, if you are a very optimistic person, you can say that this is also of phenomenological interest. There have been many papers passed about finding signatures of string or quantum gravity at future colliders, and well, you can perhaps have such things in Kaluza-Klein models with large extra dimensions, brainwork scenarios in general, if you can lower down to the TV or few TV scale the true scale of quantum gravity. And of course, you know, there are already bounds on how much you can lower this scale. Presumably, even in the most optimistic scenario, the LHC will be very marginal for producing black holes, in particular for producing semi-classical black holes, which have to be quite large compared to the Planck length. and therefore it's of interest that we can perhaps find signatures which look like black hole physics already somewhat below the expected threshold. Yeah. Yeah, but still a black hole, say, which has a string size, is not expected to be a very classical one and semi-classical, and would have probably large deviations from Hawking decay and so on. So, and I think there are already bounds on the quantum gravity scale, which are in the few TV. Plus, you have no.
No, I think that, well, at least the most recent ones I know of are around one.
One. On the other hand, then you have to take into account that in the proton-proton collider, you have to use your partons and so on and so forth. And I was reading a paper a couple of days ago, I'm Goldberg, and claiming that the efficiency goes down quite a lot when you consider
the
inelasticity.
All the partial distribution functions versus the inelasticity.
That's
I think there are fairly reasonable estimates that support you.
So you belong to the optimist. I would be very, it would be great fun. I mean, to see this.
Well,
that's
the best.
Okay, so this game started about 20 years ago, 87. And somehow independently, there were two lines of attack to this problem, one by David and Mende, and later Mende and Oguri, and the other one, more authors, for instance, Pop, Muzinich, Soldate, and ourselves published a paper basically within a week. Simultaneously, and then there have been many, many, and I'm sorry, I mean, I certainly forgot lots of them. And for instance, there, just last week, this paper, or 2 weeks ago, by Giddings and Srednicki, and our paper just came out on Monday on the archives. Now, both GMO and HCV work within superstring theory. Not all the papers actually deal with strings. Some are purely GR or, you know, quantum field theory papers. However, even then, our two approaches were very different from the start. And yet, I want to mention that they agree incredibly well in a region of phase space where they can be both justified. And this, I think, you know, landed quite a lot of credibility to both approaches. Now, I very quickly go over their approach. It was really based on considering elastic skin scattering at very high energy and fixed angle, and try to work out the asymptotic behavior, so at fixed genus by genus. And what they discovered, quite interestingly, is that the exponential damping of the elastic amplitude at fixed angle is less and less severe as you increase the genus. Okay. Of course, for each genus, you pay also a coupling constant price. And this was the expression. It's interesting that their interpretation, interesting that this exponential suppression is related to a complex saddle point in a functional integral, meaning that really strings, classical strings, would not like to have large angle scattering, but quantum mechanically you can have it through a non-real solution of the classical equation. Since we will also deal with complex solutions, I think this is an interesting remark. And then, you have to sum over the genus, the resummation was performed a la Pade, I think. Borel, I think. Resummation was performed by Mende and Oguri, and I will show very quickly the comparison with our result. So the comparison will be done in some region of energy and angle that I will make more precise later. Now, by contrast, in the paper by Amati, Cefaloni, and myself, we work in energy and impact parameter space. So our amplitude is a function of energy and impact parameter. As you know, impact parameter is related to some approximation to angular momentum. We go to arbitrarily high energy, but in order to have some approximation under control, we have to also work with a correspondingly large impact parameter. So we start working in a region in which the impact parameter exceeds by a lot the Schwarzschild radius associated with the center of mass energy, which scales like g to some power. Then, after we do this calculation in this region, we go over to energy and momentum transfer, or energy and angle, by standard Fourier transform, and we look whether the integral over B, which is in the definition of the Fourier transform, has saddle points. Okay? Saddle points which lie in the region of B in which we can trust our calculation. And if we do find the saddle point, we pick up their contribution and hope that these are the important contribution to the scattering amplitude, and we check the result, and if it makes sense, we trust it. Okay. We'll see that it usually does make sense. Now, we finally reach the regime of fixed theta, but much smaller than 1, and then try to extend this to large angle and collapse, which will be the last part of my talk. And we also compare at some point with their approach in the appropriate region. Now let's start with a three-level formula. So let's work at genus zero, and at fixed B we have to compute some rather trivial Fourier transform of the three-level amplitude function of S and T divided by S with some factors. And for instance, just to make the example of D equal 4, D will be 4 when not specified. The real part of delta grows like g times s times the log of b squared. However, there is something, this is typical also of an ordinary one graviton exchange. It's just the usual log that you get if you exchange a massless particle, for instance, is a similar log in QED, okay, if you exchange a photon. And then instead of gs, you have the fine structure constant. Now, however, the graviton being radiized in string theory, we also get an imaginary part of delta. Namely, this three-level amplitude has an imaginary part. The imaginary part, of course, as you know, doesn't have the imaginary part, you know, the S-channel discontinuity, does not have the Coulomb pole, and consequently, its Fourier transform is strongly damped at large B, is exponentially damped. So we have to remember that there is an imaginary part, but it is only relevant if the impact parameter is smaller than what we call some inelasticity impact parameter, which modulo a log is basically the string length. So this is a genuine string effect, and I remind you of the old duality, Dolan-Horn-Schmidt duality. It has to do with that basic duality. So if you have this string scattering amplitude, you have your closed strings exchanging the T-channel, which corresponds to these regions. They give the Coulomb singularity. But you also have closed strings in the S-channel, which corresponds to producing heavy closed strings. And the imaginary part of the amplitude is related to this yellow heavy strings being produced. Now, the three-level violates partial wave unitarity because the amplitude in impact parameter grows like gs, and then eventually the partial wave will just exceed the unitarity bound. I remember that Michael Green made this observation shortly before we started our calculation. Now, on the other hand, the tree level is too large, it's too large at fixed z, it's too small at fixed theta. For instance, at fixed genus, the amplitude goes down exponentially in S, which is faster than the Cerulus Martin bound. So, hopefully, and we'll see that this happens, string loops, either done a la GMO or done our way, should take care of both problems, okay? Should somehow take some of the amplitude or some of the cross-section away from fixed B and bring it to fixed theta. Now, what do we expect before we go into the results? What would we expect from GR type, general relativity type argument, purely classical GR argument? Well, if you have point particle collisions, there were old results by Penrose, Diaz, and Payne that for a completely central two-particle collision, head-on collision at B equals zero, more than a fraction E over square root of 2 of the incoming of the center of mass energy would go into forming a black hole. Then in 2002, there was this very nice development by Erdley and Giddings showing that indeed, also at B non-equal to zero, you can argue on the basis of constructing a closed trap surface that below a certain value of the impact parameter, you would form a black hole. And this has been also slightly refined by this group of people. As one example, which I will use later, in D equal 4, the critical ratio of R over B turns out to be somewhere below 1.25. The reason for the less or equal is because this closed trap surface criterion is only a sufficient criterion for collapse. The collapse could in principle occur for larger values of B over R and therefore for smaller value of R over B. Now, there is another case which I think is of interest and on which we will come back in my talk, which is the case of having extended sources collide. These are extended sources made out of massless quanta, so they still, you know, have light-like momentum because all these massless particles travel in the same direction. So there was an old paper by Yurtsever, which actually starts from the opposite end. Infinitely extended source is a problem of two plane waves, but which have infinitely extended wave fronts and are actually homogeneous over the transverse plane. Why doing that? Because that problem can be solved analytically. In that case, you find the singularity, I think it's even an eight singularity and so on. And then Yurtsever in later work, he and others produced the exact analytic solution of that problem, but then they extend, Yurtsever used arguments to extend his results to finite fronted waves. And however, he made only some qualitative calculation. And then a student of mine and I, using the technique of Erdley and Giddings, looked at closed trap surfaces for that situation. And one example, we made several examples, but one which will be relevant for this talk, is the central collision of two homogeneous beams of radius L. And then we found that R over L critical was below 1. I mean, in other words, we could construct the closed trap surface for R over L bigger than 1. And being a sufficient criteria, this tells us that the critical value should be somewhere below 1. Now, the string length parameter Elias plays the role of the beam size, essentially, and therefore you do have indeed like three parameters in the problem. The impact parameter, the Schwarzschild radius, I will usually omit the label S for Schwarzschild, so R will always be R Schwarzschild, and the string length. And now, corresponding to these three parameters, you can think of three different regimes in terms of Planckian superstring scattering, depending on which one of these three lengths is larger than the other two. Very roughly speaking, this is what is most important. And according to this, you have three regimes, which you can classify as small angle, large angle, and stringy. And we shall take the coupling constant fixed, and very small, okay? Even smaller than what is supposedly experimentally known. So, in that case, since we have three lengths, we have two ratios, and then we measure everything, say, string length unit, or anyway, we fix the string length to be much bigger than the Planck length. And then this plane, RP, gets divided into three parts. This is where B is largest, this is where LS is largest, this is where R is largest. And the basic physics is that this region, if you are sufficiently far from this line, is the region of small angle scattering. This is the region where string effects dominate. And we expect that some kind of critical line in this plane, which goes more or less like this red line, crossing which we should enter into some regime of gravitational collapse. Now, of course, this is a difficult region to analyze. So we will start over here, quite far away, and then we will move to this region. And this is some work I did actually here during my last visit on trying to move from this region towards the black hole region, and the recent work we did is actually instead to go directly at very large energies from here down here, but somehow in the end everything should square up. Now, one thing which is important is that I will immediately give you a leading iconal formula whose corrections scale like the Schwarzschild radius divided by the impact parameter to some power, positive power. But because of this string size effect, this impact parameter is blurred a little bit by quantum effects, and it's effectively replaced by the impact parameter plus the string length. So that if you are in this region, 3, where the string length is bigger than RS, even if B is small, these corrections are under control. And this is why we can make progress in this region without knowing all these nasty classical corrections. On the other hand, if we move in this direction, then R is the biggest one of the three lengths, and therefore these corrections are there, and there is no other way than face them.
It's fine that its correction takes that far. I mean, it must be order relative.
Order.
I mean, I'm sorry. The correction the next one, because there's the. I mean, that's a different sort of way out.
These dimensions, you have.
In the regularization.
Yeah.
I mean, is that the same?
Yeah.
Position space, if this is what the regularization is, just changing.
You mean regularization?
The exponent of alpha drawing. This is dominated by a very high loop amplitude. The regime 1.
Okay.
Very high loop amplitude.
Yeah, I will explain this. If you hold on, I will go into detail. When we go to the last part of the talk, I will make some power counting and hopefully answer this question. Yeah. So the kind of S mapping which holds actually both in regions 1 and 3 is extremely simple, if you want. It comes from resumming, in fact, I think I have the diagram, very simple diagrams in which you exchange gravitons, radiized gravitons, so there is a little pick here, okay, the discussion, Reggie Eisen had this imaginary part, I'll come to that in a moment, and also we can include the possibility that this external particle, I mean these are the external particles, get excited. These are strings, they're not particles, and then they can get excited. So, but modulo these two important string effects, one is the absorptive part, the imaginary part of this diagram, second is the string excitation. These are very simple ladder diagrams. Of course, you have to include the cross ladders. I mean, for simplicity, we didn't draw them. Now, they take up the tree amplitude and exponentiate it in impact parameter space, but of course, with various corrections and various effects. So, let me give you the formula. So the S matrix, which is explicitly unitary here, contains e to the 2i delta, and then two exponentials of some creation and distraction operators, where these creation and distraction operators will be related to the cutting through the graviton propagator. So these are these S-channel heavy strings in the S-channel. Notice that this creation and distraction operator are only activated when imaginary delta is there. So a large impact parameter, remember imaginary delta was dying out exponentially, so we can completely neglect this phenomenon. But as we go from region 1 to region 3, what I call 3, the stringy region, these operators get activated. Now, this is not actually the full story. Actually, delta itself becomes an operator. C and C dagger create and annihilate the heavy strings that you get when you cut through the graviton exchange, the ones of my diagram. Whereas the other complication, which for today I will ignore, because otherwise it takes me too long, is that the operator delta itself becomes an operator, and but this is an operator in the sense of first quantized string theory, which controls the excitation of the string themselves. In other words, I think this perhaps is better. So.
C is
related actually to S channel.
But C is not just a single oscillator.
No, that's right. It's a collective way of taking into account the fact that there is an absorptive part. But I agree, this is a very gross way of accounting for this imaginary part, for this channel. But, I mean, if one wanted a detailed understanding of the final state, one would have to introduce many such operators.
And for very large energy and small angle, that's going to change.
Yeah. I mean, the details are not very important. But I mean, if you want really detailed information on the final state, which we may want, then you would have to do what David was saying. Now, what we can do easily is to have a detailed information over this so-called diffractively produced closed strings. And this is done by turning the delta. I think I skipped something. Oh, I see. I'm pushing the wrong button. That's why. Okay, what happens is that in the expression for delta of B, you have to replace B by B minus or plus the difference of a position operator of this string and the position operator of that string. And once you do that, you can take into account diffractive excitation of the string, which has been recognized, I think, probably by Giddings the first time.
B plus L string?
Yeah.
Then why is there all these plots?
Well, it turns out that you have to, I understand. It's actually, I think a better expression would be like B squared plus L string squared. Namely, the first order usually goes away, but the second order gives the positive definite contribution. Yeah. Okay, so we will instead concentrate on those dagger corresponding to this regularization, but as I just said, in a rather inclusive way, without looking too much into the details of the that. We will count them, but will not classify them.
In the real case, that they're also energy dependent, the structure of
them. That's right, because actually we will, for many of them, because a multi-loop diagram can be cut through many, many of these, and we will count them, and they will have therefore an energy which also depends on how many there are, and so on. So this is a story which I think eventually should be made much more precise if we want to really to understand what's going on. But for the moment, let's be happy with this rough accounting. At least we don't neglect that there is an opening of this channel, because it becomes very important.
So it's as if there was a fixed mass particle.
Yeah, that's right. One particle of some energy, which actually depends also on how many of them you cut through. So it's really quite rough. But as we will see, it gives some non-trivial and quite interesting result. So if we go to the region 1 and we look at the leading iconal, I repeat the formula here, the real and the imaginary part. But if we go to this region B, much bigger than the string length, we forget about the C. We take the formula for real delta, we do this Fourier transform back into scattering angle, and we find, in fact, a saddle point B, which is given in terms of the scattering angle and the energy by this formula, which written in this other way, theta equal a relation related to the saddle, corresponds, if I plug in here the precise factor that we get, corresponds exactly to the relation between the impact parameter and the deflection angle in for geodesics which hit the metric, which fill the geometry generated by the other relativistic point particle which comes against it. So this is called the Eichel-Bosexel metric, and it all works very nicely. And by the way, Toft, with his great intuition, got the results in this reverse order. He said, the particle should see a shock wave, the geodesic should have some kind of time shift. We multiply the time shift by the energy, we get the phase shift. He got the factor of 2 right, because I don't know how he guessed that you shouldn't add the phase shift of one and the shape shift of the other. If you do the 2, you get twice the right result. But then we'll so he used directly GR intuitions and GR input. What we did here was not to assume any metric from the start. We have our collision happening in flat space time, and yet what you see in the end is that, of course, through all this multi-graviton exchange, you generate the same effect as if you had assumed that there was a metric. So it's like an effective metric. In fact, what is amusing, it's a small digression, is that I don't think that quantizing strings in this Eichel-Bosexel would be good. They will lead probably to anomalies in the sigma model. These are not conformal vectors in which you can quantize the string. So I think it's very interesting that they come out as effective metric and not as the basic background in which you try to quantize your strings.
So you're just worried about the source, because it does satisfy all the
things. Yeah, Einstein, well, that's right. Or if I take a beam, it will be even more spread. In other words, it's not that really, I think there will be problems with ghosts and other things if you try to quantize.
Well,
for instance, the Amati-Klimchik like backgrounds, which are good conformal backgrounds, do not have a source. This I know. So this, I think, would be true. This is part of my general philosophy. One should to stay away from backgrounds in which you cannot quantize the string. So all other GR backgrounds should only be seen as effective backgrounds that come out of having strings moving in an allowed one.
Well, in any case,
the
back reaction
means quite a few terms anyway. That's right. So, in any case. Okay, but this goes too philosophical, I guess. So, I think I'll skip this point, I don't need to make it. So, if we move to this region 3, I remind you what that is. And we look for a moment to the real part of the amplitude, there, instead of going like a log of b squared or some negative power of b in higher dimensions, the real part goes like b squared itself. And in fact, if you do the usual subtle point approximation, you now find that the scattering angle is proportional to b instead of being inversely proportional to b. And the proportionality constant is g newton times some energy density per unit transverse area, which you can see as the energy density in an extended object, a string of size L string times some log. So this, again, corresponds to the deflection of geodesics from an homogeneous, now, beam of massless particles. Because it is well known that such a geometry focuses all the geodesics exactly at the same point. There is a focal distance. Anyway, so this also seems to make some sense. By the way, it is clear from this picture that the maximum deflection angle is reached when the impact parameter coincides with the size of the beam. However, nobody forbids us from asking the question, what is the cross-section if we go to even larger angles? It will not be a classical saddle point which contributes to it, it will be a complex saddle point. And when we take that into account, that's where we find agreement, almost perfect agreement, between our result and the result of GMO. You see that the only discrepancy is in this log, which is very typical already of three level. Instead of alpha prime s, you get t over s somehow. So you get a theta instead of the alpha prime s. But this is already clear when you compare fixed t. So in any case, I think the agreement is quite amazing if you think that the two are completely, completely different calculations. Now, we turn finally to the effects of imaginary delta, which is roughly taken into account by the C and C dagger operators, just to say that if now you turn on imaginary delta, of course the elastic amplitude is suppressed as exponential minus 2 imaginary delta, and the cross section by the square.
In your way of doing things, you have a way. So in our way of doing things, to get that answer, you're essentially picking out, aside from everything else, a saddle point in the genus.
Mm-hmm.
So we can sort of say...
A saddle point in the sum of the genus, you mean?
In the genus.
Oh, in the genus,
that's
okay.
How the
okay.
Works, right? I mean, it's slip, real transformers are bad way of saying it because you actually have a series that isn't real transformer.
Yeah.
So what you're really doing, is looking at the saddle point in that song.
Mm-hmm. Sum of rage. I think we can also roughly pick up. I mean, this is something we have done usually. I don't think I ever checked that particular point whether we agree with the particular, with the dominant genius
roughly
contribution.
Speaking, it's clear that the original entities go like energy squared over genius.
Mm-hmm.
And then they end up going like energy.
Mm-hmm.
So the mean genius goes like the energy.
Yeah, it will be certainly something which goes now exactly, I mean, roughly speaking, it will certainly do that, but I don't know if...
In pictures, it's where you wrap up just enough times of the size of the circle.
Yeah. But you say the sum of the genus itself is done by a sadhu, basically.
Yeah.
And the dominant genus should match, too.
Right.
I don't know if I ever checked that, because it has been a long time, but it should work. I'm pretty sure. So if we come back to this now in elasticity because of the imaginary of delta, and we compute the sigma elastic, we find something which is exponentially killed with e to the minus s scaled by a certain scale, which turns out to be actually m string over g. So it's the geometric mean between the string scale and what I call string hole or threshold scale for black hole production. This in V equals 4 happens to be just MP and Planck, otherwise it's something somewhat bigger. And it's interesting that if we follow this exponential suppression up to this threshold, M threshold, then it's clear. When you do s over m star square, you will get e to the minus 1 over g square. So the elastic cross-section, as you reach the supposed threshold of black hole production, where we actually should stop believing in our calculation, will go like e to the minus the entropy, this string hole or black hole entropy. So that looks quite interesting because it could have the interpretation that the elastic cross-section is just killed because it's one of the e to the plus s channels in which the initial state could go. And an amusing observation, out of which we were not able to make any sense or justification, is that this m star is the D0 brain mass scale. Why? I don't know. At the when you reach this threshold, yeah. This is, by the way, what in this last paper of Giddings and Srednicki is proposed, right? Basically, right? That the elastic cross-section is killed, but not by this mechanism, but again by similar arguments of. Because, okay, what we are saying is that, yeah, because you would go like I will do in the last part of the talk, along this other direction, down to a critical L or a critical B. Here I go to a critical energy scale where I also try to penetrate. So somehow along this critical curve, it all work out that way. So now, we will see, however, that we don't quite get this in the end. Okay, so there is an interesting issue there. So the typical state via the optical theorem will consist of many of these cut gravitons, and an interesting observation is also that the energy per the individual average energy of each of these C particles, cut region particles will be the total energy divided by their number. And you can, oh, sorry, perhaps I went a bit too fast. Of course, having a coherent state, having an S matrix of this type, you apply this to the vacuum of the C operator, it produces a coherent state of C particles, and these C particles will obey a Poisson distribution with an average which is just given by 4 in delta. So the average number of particles is also of this order, S over M star square. So finally, the average energy will scale like M star square divided by the center of mass energy. And therefore, we find that the final state energy obeys sort of anti-scaling law. Instead of the energy of the produced particle being proportional to the incoming energy, they are inversely proportional to it. And this, although unlike what we are familiar with in high energy physics, is similar to what we would expect in black hole physics, where the temperature of the black hole is inversely proportional to the mass. So, to summarize,
again, you know, I mean, here you're really sensitive to the treating this.
To the?
All the string states as one particle.
Yeah. But, okay, of course, these have to decay, and the life will be very complicated. However, the fact that there is a basic increase in the multiplicity above a certain M star seems to be quite a solid conclusion, and therefore what you'd expect is that the energy of the produced quanta goes up to a certain scale, but then starts to decrease. And if you go again to the presumed threshold of black hole production, you find that parametrically the energy of this secondary particles is the string scale. So you see, by the time you go to this energy, actually you don't produce very excited objects, but just maybe, you know, just the first few levels of the string excitation. The typical energy will be the string scale, which of course is at this particular scale, it's also the black hole temperature, because the black holes you produce have Schwarzschild radius equal to string length. So, in other words, it seems that you get some kind of precocious black hole-like behavior and some softening of the final state. So, if you want to be optimistic again, you could say that one way to see signatures of this phenomena as colliders would be to try to look for events which are high multiplicity and pretty soft and so on. But certainly we don't expect this to be thermal or, you know, Hawking-like, but to have some characteristics, let's say.
And those exactly states that you throw away?
That we throw away, where?
Because they're very soft.
You mean that we throw? Oh. Well, now, because of all these proposals of looking for black holes with LHC, I understand that the experimentalists have put some trigger for spherical events and so on. I mean, no. If you don't look at them, you may throw them away.
You're gonna have a shower of soft particles. You should dance.
Yeah, that's right. The point is, what they typically throw away are very minimum bias events with very small pt for particles. But I think this will be not so. Well, I understood that some detectors may try to catch events like this, but I'm not sure. Okay, so we finally come to the last part of the talk. When did I start? Was it, an hour ago? Wow. As bad as at Irvine. Well, I thought I would go faster, but you asked a few questions and, okay. So, remember these were the diagrams we included in our leading iconal, you know, plus string corrections here and there. Now we'll forget for the moment about the string correction. Maybe eventually we have to put everything in, strings and classical corrections. Now, what are the classical corrections and where do they come from? They come, of course, when in these dots you have no h-bar, okay? Simply, by definition of classical. And actually only, if you neglect the string effect, only the ratio R over B enters. And as it turns out, the corrections in four dimensions depend on even powers of that ratio. And not surprisingly, they are related to three diagrams once the coupling of the external energetic particles are replaced by the source. So these are the basic diagrams that enter. You exchange gravitons, but the gravitons reinteract in general through a tree diagram. And if you look really at the exponent, the phase of the S matrix, then only connected trees enter. Now let's look at a connected tree just to see the power counting. This is the simplest next to leading correction, we call it the H diagram. And you see, you count the powers of G, you have G cubed, you count the power of S, two graviton exchanges in the partial wave gives a square, and you always factor out the factor GS, the providential factor GS, because GS can always be taken as large as you like, so it makes the action very large, and then GS multiplies G square S, but G square S is just R square. And then by dimensional arguments or by looking at the PT structure of the diagram, you realize that this is a 1 over B squared. So this will be a correction to GS log S, which scales like R squared over B squared. And if you go to the next diagram and you repeat the argument, you find GS R squared over B squared all squared. So it's clear that when R becomes of order B, these diagrams have to be kept and resummed. The technical point is that we neglect, in this first go, this so-called rescattering diagram, is in which the produced graviton rescatters off the external legs or sources. And we think we can justify this for B over R not too small. I mean, not parametrically small, but for instance, a fixed small ratio is okay, we think.
Now that thing there, that wiggly thing, can, there's no reason why it has to be
a graviton. Exactly. Can be a string, can be a dilaton, can be another massless particle, and so on. So again, this is, because this could be eventually what the Hawking radiation is, or could be part of the Hawking radiation, we don't quite know. But there is no reason why that should be fitted to graviton. So indeed, while irrespective of whether your theory has other massless particles, we know that the graviton exchange dominates at high energy because of spin 2. For the produced particles, David is absolutely right. So,
but is there a reason to expect that the excited contribution for those will be significant?
I don't know. You mean to put massive objects here?
Well, yeah, that's what.
Yeah, it could be, but yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, if they're very heavy, string size, and the momentum transfers are smallish, then they could be suppressed. I mean, the momentum transfers will be perhaps typical of the 1 over R or 1 over B, then. But, of course, other massless particles, for instance, you know. Then I think it's a question of threshold. There is no other. So anyway, in the approximation in which we neglect various things, this rescattering diagram, we also neglect one of these two polarizations of this physical graviton, what we call LT polarization for some reasons. We neglect it because it's a bit technically harder to deal with because it has infrared divergences, so it has to be treated a la Bloch Nordsig, and it's a little bit complicated. So we restricted our attention for the moment to the what we call the infrared safe QT polarization. Within all these approximations, we can generate all these three diagrams from a simple 2D effective action, which goes back to work by Lipatov and also some work of ours years ago. This effective action contains three real fields. What we call A and A bar represents the longitudinal plus plus or minus minus components of the gravitational field, and they are coupled to the corresponding light-like components of the energy momentum tensor of the incoming particle. And phi, which is real if we neglect the other polarization, if not can be accounted for by a complex field, is this produced graviton, physical graviton field. Of course, if you had other particles, you have to add the mean and put in the corresponding vertices. And the whole, you see that those diagrams, if you neglect the Rischettian diagrams, they are completely given in terms of vertices, of one vertex, basically, and three different propagators. So the propagators of A bar is here, it gives the Coulomb, you know, once you invert, it gives the Coulomb force. The propagator of phi is a little complicated. Of course, you could introduce a field. In fact, we do introduce a field, which is delta square of phi, but okay. In any case, you see that there are several interesting structures and high derivative terms. However, when you look carefully, you see that there are no infrared problems because of precisely this structure, you see, which goes to zero if the two momenta are parallel and so on. So it's cooked up in such a nice way that everything is really well defined and finite. And the semi-classical approximation corresponds to solving the equations of motion and then computing the classical action on the solution, and then this gives the SMET.
So H is like the stress tensor of the two sources.
Yeah, it is the source, right, is the source, is the current which generates the field phi. I think this would have, I was lazy not to change it, and say it would be nicer to put the box square on the H, and then it's given by here. So phi, the source of phi is box square H, which is given by this expression, which is, you see, K1 square, K2 square, minus K1, K2 square, which means there is a sine square theta, and that sine square theta is what kills the infrared problem. So when K goes to zero, call K the momentum of this field phi, which you see could become dangerous when it's solved. But if K goes to zero, then K1 is equal to K2, and then the sine squared theta nicely saves you from the singularity. That doesn't happen in the other polarization, which instead of having a sine squared theta has a single sign and is still logarithmically divergent, which is just what you expect, and it fits with Weinberg's current for soft graviton, so it's all under control, but it's technically hard. So we decided. Yeah, that would be going higher dimension. So there is a price to pay and an advantage if you go to higher dimensions. For the moment, we decided to stay in 4, but. Okay, now, since time is running out, I can only give you a sketch of this. You could find details in the paper. But basically, what we did first was to look at the axisymmetric cases, actually. One is particle-particle collision at B equals zero, where, however, we really don't trust the approximation. So it's really more like a warm-up exercise. But if you do that, you find a slight problem, because then the equations are ordinary differential equations. You can look at them. You find that they look like the motion of a particle in dot means ddr square. R is the transverse distance from the symmetry axis, and it looks like motion in a repulsive Coulomb potential, and therefore rho cannot go to zero, okay, as it is clear from this first integral of the equation. some appropriate boundary condition. So rho dot square is 1 minus this, and therefore at infinity rho dot is 1, and it can never go to 0, as you see. But if rho does not go to 0, even at r square equals 0, it means that phi dot must blow up. So we seem to be forced, if we want a real solution, into something not very nice. The singular phi dot, or phi, has some bad consequences. So let's look at a nicer case, which is coming back to these extended beams. Then you can still be axisymmetric, but play with the dimensionless ratio of the size of the beams to the Schwarzschild radius related to their center of mass energy. And there, the equations are slightly different from the one of the previous case, because they are modified below. They are just the same for r bigger than the size of the beam, just the same, but below they are changed, they are softened. They, in particular, see rho dot goes to zero. And then you can solve the system partly analytically, partly by just solving a simple differential ODE on the computer. And you end up with the interesting conclusion that your perturbation theory diverges at a value which we estimated at 0.7 for that ratio. And this, you know, compares rather nicely to the upper bound that I was quoting before of r over l equal 1.0. Now, when we go to non-axisymmetric solution, we have to make either approximations to do something analytic or resort to computer, okay, to solve a PDE on the computer. Now, by now, well, we have this analytic computations, but because of lack of time, it will take too much. And we have, by now, some numerical solution without any approximation. I mean, don't worry about this. This means numerical solutions of the equations as they are, okay? And this have been solved in MATLAB, mainly by Onofri, but also with the help of Pino Marchesini. And the iterative procedure converges only for b bigger than something like, this is the last number that Onofri gave me, showed me very nice checks of the program. It seems that lots of things are really under control, but okay, take them as preliminary. Now here, again, there is a factor of 2, even somewhat larger, between 2 and 3, between what we find to be the critical and the lower bound that they gave with the closed trap surface. Again, we are compatible, we don't know, we neglect certain things, they only have a lower bound, so. But, okay, we are in the same ballpark numbers.
But this is really suggesting you form something like a black hole out to this larger radius.
Yeah. Now, there is still one puzzling thing, maybe it's the last thing I will tell you about because of time. Okay, we try to look also at the particle creation, the particle spectrum, the graviton spectrum. And but okay, I wanted to go more to this. When we look at the action on the equation of motion near BC, we find this well, in some analytic approximation which we think we can trust, okay? This has to be confirmed, honestly speaking, by those exact numerical calculation. I mean, I think that's what they are doing right now, to try to see what happens numerically near BC. So this is the result of the analytic approximation to the non-axisymmetric case. So we find that the action near the critical point has an analytic piece, which by taking the usual derivative with respect to B can be related to the scattering angle, and you find an angle, you know, which is bigger than pi over 2. I mean, some number, but I think the real way to go this is to follow Giddings and Srebrenicki and go to angular momentum, because you start to talk about PT here, doesn't make much sense. But what is interesting is this kind of threshold behavior near B equal BC, okay, which appears to be quite robust. It came many, many times during different kind of approximations. So, and we would like
different
to...
Different approximations to your...
Well, for instance, we made approximations in because we also reformulated all the problems in momentum space and made a slightly different average and so on. And this seems to remain, this behavior. A priori, it looks like there is a square root, okay? Just a square root like branch point. But when you compute the coefficient of the square root, you find typically a zero, an extra zero. I think that Marcello Ciafaloni has some arguments of why this has to be. But it's related to solving a cubic. By the way, there is another amusing, perhaps, coincidence, and that, see, when we try to establish this critical point, we find an equation, a cubic equation, which is amazingly similar to the one that determines the turning point in the Schwarzschild metric. When you have a Schwarzschild metric and you send a particle in, you try to compute the turning point, you find the cubic equation, which is written there, which only has a solution if b is bigger than 3 square root of 3 over 2. And the same number appears here, although here it refers to b over r, and here is b squared over r squared. So. But it seems to be in the nature of this cubic equation to have this property, that then the action on the solution has this power 3 half. Now, we were a little bit puzzled by that. Why? Because if we say, well, perhaps we do form a Kerr black hole below this impact parameter, then the temperature of a Kerr black hole near criticality goes like the square root of Gs minus J, which is the equivalent of our B minus 1 minus B over BC. However, so we would get something which goes like the third power of T. However, remember our feeling that maybe the elastic amplitude should go like e to the minus the entropy. If you look at the entropy of the Kerr black hole near extremality, it's not at all vanishing. It goes just differs by a factor of 2 from the entropy of the Schwarzschild black hole of the same mass. And then one possibility is that, of course, we it's a consequence of our approximation. But if you take it more seriously, it would seem to indicate, it was actually suggested by Giddings, that this means that the mass of the black hole itself goes to zero as B goes to BC. And that, I think, I then looked a little bit in the literature, is called type 2 critical collapse. You probably have heard about the numerical work by Chopwick, which studies, in fact, critical collapse and has found some critical exponents.
Yeah,
it's a spherically symmetric collapse. But then it has led to an explosion of papers, and I have a review paper by Gondlach. Yeah. Apparently, this has also been done in non-spherically symmetric case. Seems to be a very generic phenomenon, and people talk in analogy with phase transition about type 1 and type 2, or in the sense that the mass of the black hole could turn on suddenly above the critical value of the parameter, or could just grow smoothly from zero. So this is a more typical Chopwick-like situation in which you have a critical exponent. Then if we try to interpret our results in this language, gamma or chocolate would be 0.75 in this case.
People studying this critical flash of the net angular momentum?
I think there is also. Yeah, I think so. But I have not found, I tried to search only for a few days, I must say, about whether this case has been discussed in the literature, and I have not found.
I doubt if it's been discussed in this computer.
No. I have not found.
Well, it's sort of the maximum impact parameter, so it's very high.
Yeah, they usually start the collapse of a fluid with some equation of state. And what is known is that the critical exponent depends on the equation of state. It's a work by Mason. It's still very crazy, but I think there is also, because I read people thought that maybe it's an artifact of spherical symmetry, but actually I think there are results also outside. So I mean I would not be
The only results that I know about some spherical symmetry or for cylindrical symmetry or some other
cylindrical there also.
So
yeah.
Net angular momentum, I don't know what the problem's been studying.
Uh-huh.
Also, you know,
maybe it has not been there. I looked, of course, I was curious to see whether
it's supposed to be something that, you know, where you can't have radiation.
Right.
Otherwise, you don't expect that. Why maybe, you know, you shouldn't be able to create it, make it seem like generically, you know, there are directions where this goes away.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are, for sure. And I thought it was just something in the mind.
So,
axisymmetric also can
radiate.
What?
Yes, axisymmetric can radiate. Yes. In fact, I mean, this is the Penrose case. And our case. So,
and there certainly is radiation in cylindrical symmetry.
No.
It's axisymmetric.
No, but wait a moment. Maybe you are confusing two things. One thing is gravitational waves, okay? And one thing is radiating away energy at infinity. For instance, in the spherical collapse, much energy is radiated to infinity. I mean, doesn't collapse. I mean, that's why you can form very small black holes. Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is the work of Christodoulou, I mean, trying to find when there is collapse. But it is true that in some cases he finds also critical collapse and the next singularity, but it's a very fine-tuned situation where it has an next singularity. Generally, you do form a horizon. So, I mean, this is very new to me, and I didn't have time to look into it, but okay, if any, this would be the kind of suggestion. I think I don't want to take more of your time. I conclude. Yeah. Well, we have some respondents. I don't know what to do with it, whether we should say that this should be the spoon. Yeah, of course. Of course. Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. The critical. How is it called?
Just the exponent is more, doesn't appear in there as well.
What?
Luis is getting it from the change in the exponent.
I think so. But he was also referring to Chopkin's work. I remember, and trying to match the saturation curve for parton distribution. Okay, so to conclude, just a couple of transparencies. I think that perhaps Trans-Planckian collisions may play a role similar to Gedanken experiments in the early days of quantum mechanics in understanding how and whether quantum mechanics and GR are mutually compatible. Now, we think that in superstring theory, in flat space time, or possibly in other consistent vectors, you know, by now even Joe people have tried to do these iconal approximations in ADS and other frameworks where maybe there are advantages. Now, work on this problem has been going on and off for about 20 years. And okay, what we described were these three regimes, which I will not repeat. I think you got the point. And well, okay, what came out to us as rather a surprise is that within the drastic approximations that we made, the results based on this effective action approach match quite well the GR arguments, at least as far as identification of the critical B over R ratio is concerned. And then we have made these first steps towards constructing a unitary S-matrix, understanding the physics of the process, and we shall see. Of course, the standard final sentence is that much more work is needed. You are all welcome to join. But I think that you know, some understanding of this, of whatever replaces general relativity's gravitational collapse in a quantum theory, looks within reach. Okay, thank you very much. That's all.
Mm-hmm. I guess one way to look at it is this is a proposal for sort of continuing around that.
Yes.
Which you may or may not.
Well, I had the transparency in which I was discussing two possibilities. I mean, it seems to us that our equations either are kept real all the time, and then we hit some very bad singularity at the origin, at r equals zero. So bad that, for instance, if you integrate the action by parts, you know, standard things, you may get different results because you get some crazy boundary term coming from r equals zero. So after much debate, I must say that we oscillated ourselves. If you read the paper, we took the attitude finally that we should not insist on real solutions and we should go for the nicely behaved but complex solutions. And then the question is how you go around the singularity. Now it seems that unitarity, analytic continuation suggests a definite prescription, but well, for instance, otherwise you may get an amplitude which explodes instead of being damped and so on. But this is the, but one thing that I should emphasize more is that we don't quite understand what I showed you this form of the action near the critical point, and it has this extra imaginary part, of course, as you go through this branch point. Now, what is responsible for this extra absorption? Okay, this is a big question where the three authors even debate among themselves. Namely, we have not really identified the source of this extra absorption.
Well, it looks like the absorption going in, well, basically making a black hole that brings into the other channel.
Yeah, but where is the black hole? Is the black hole to be identified with strings again in the spirit of this correspondence with these strings that are produced in the S channel? I mean, can we understand? Because otherwise we have to invent a new channel. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would maybe sympathize with that. For instance, Daniele Amati doesn't want to hear that. He said, oh, no, there are no black holes. No, I mean, it would be nice to see if in a complete theory, like string theory, there is even an identification of the black hole with something, or whether it's just a new object that we have to put in and so on. So, strictly speaking, we have not really completed our program of understanding how unitarity is preserved. I mean, we see this extra absorption, and the S matrix is really not unitary anymore unless you say, aha, that is the channel. this thing. So this argument, maybe this this scaling of the mass of the black hole with the distance from the critical point, may suggest a black hole interpretation. So, as I said, we made, I think, some progress, but it's still a long way, I'm sure. So there's plenty to do. Oh, okay. Then we'll ask in private.
So, but